owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
I love the Army. It reared me, it nurtured me, and it gave me the most satisfying years of my life. Thanks to it, I have lived an entire lifetime in 26 years. It is only fitting that I should die in its service. We all have but one death to spend, and insofar as it can have any meaning, it finds it in the service of comrades in arms. And yet, I deny that I died for anything. Not my country, not my army, not my fellow man, none of those things. I lived for these things, and the manner in which I chose to do it involved the very real chance that I would die in the execution of my duties. I knew this and accepted it, but my love for West Point and the Army was great enough, and the promise that I would someday be able to serve all the ideals that meant anything to me through it was great enough. For me to accept this possibility as part of a price which must be paid for all things of great value. If there is nothing worth dying for, in this sense, there is nothing worth living for. The Army is my life. It is such a part of what I was that what happened is logical outcome of the life I loved. I never knew what it was like to be failed. I never knew what it was like to be too old or too tired to do anything. I lived a full life in the Army and has exacted the price. It is only just. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. What I just read to you was some excerpts from the self-obituary of then-Captain John Alexander Hotell III. He wrote it when he was 26 years old and mailed it in a sealed envelope to his wife. Captain Hotell would be killed 1 year later in Vietnam. This season is a time of reflection for many of us. It begins with the consideration of what is past and showing gratitude for what we have been given. The season ends, hopefully, with many of us making commitments to lead better lives. Naturally, because it's essential to the mission of American Warrior Radio, I find myself thinking all year long about those who volunteer to protect us. Why do they do what they do, and why the rest of us should be grateful? I don't presuppose that any of us who have never served will really understand them, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try, and at least appreciate their sacrifice and that of their entire family. As you enjoy this time of year with your families, I ask you to remember this. When a soldier, an airman, a sailor, a marine, or a coastie goes to war, the entire family goes to war. The rest of us don't have to experience it because they volunteer to do so. Now, as I've said, I'm no expert, so joining us today on American Warrior Radio is someone I consider to be an expert, not only because of his Army service and that of his wife and his father and grandfathers and soon to be his daughter, but also because he has published several articles in the Havoc Journal that strike to the heart of what I'm trying to communicate today. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Faint.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me back on the show. It feels great to be back on American Warrior Radio.
Well, I led with that obituary of Major Hotell because that was one of your articles, Charles, that really struck me. And there, in the theme of today's conversation of why you all do what you do, which still makes me scratch my head, but I'm very appreciative, there's a lesson in there in that he spoke about what he lived for and not what he died for. You follow that up in your article, It's Only Just. So share from your perspective, reflecting on his perspective.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So John Hotell was a captain in the 82nd Airborne Division, and he died in a helicopter crash in Vietnam. He was a Silver Star recipient and a West Point graduate, and I first came across his story at West Point. I'm not a graduate, but I've worked there for going on 8 years now. And there's a plaque in 1st Division Barracks, also known as Manager Hall, which is one of the oldest buildings in continuous existence on West Point. And it had a brass plaque with his obituary from the New York Times on it. I found it very inspirational and very interesting for what he said he lived for more so than what he died for. And I think that's a great example of what drives a lot of members of the military is not so much what we're dying for, which happens often, but more importantly, what we're living for and what we're trying to protect. So that's what I was trying to get across in that article, Ben.
Now, he talks about a life rich with experiences, and I didn't read the whole thing, but he climbed mountains. He did some amazing stuff during his time with the Army before Vietnam. And I find it maybe a little bit ironic. He died at 27, and Charles, now you've spent 27 years in the Army yourself.
Wow, that's right. Yeah, I didn't make that connection, but you're absolutely right. So I spent as much time in the Army as he spent on Earth, unfortunately cut short in Vietnam. But, yeah, it's very interesting, very inspirational, and it's also an indicator of the types of opportunities that even a short career in the military can provide for someone. So a lot of things of what he's talking about, going to Japan, Germany, and England. He got to go to Oxford University. He got to go to do a semester at the German Military Academy. Lots of opportunities out there for people in the military, and that's kind of what he celebrated in his auto obituary, which again ran in the New York Times after his death.
Now, Charles, you've had some very intriguing assignments during your time in the Army, some of which we still and probably won't be able to talk about for another 50 years, but you are currently at West Point yourself as instructor, professor, what do we call you?
Yes, so we call ourselves instructor. My academic rank is assistant professor, which is kind of the next step up. So this is I am the deputy director of the Modern War Institute, MWI, where we focus on helping the Army prepare to win tomorrow's wars today. So I also teach a class in leadership and future war, in which we read this article and we talk about John Hoddle. And we actually I give the cadets an assignment to write their own self-obituary. And sometimes when they're asked to do this, I've done this for several semesters now, it seems a bit morbid. But it's also a chance for them to recognize what they've got and be thankful for what they've got, and also to consider how inherently dangerous our profession is. And I also give them a choice. They can either write a self-obituary along the model of Captain Hoddle, or they can write a consolation letter to the family of an imaginary soldier from their unit. And some people pick the first and some take the second option. But then we get to have a conversation about how precious life is and how important it is and what's important to you and how you want to be remembered. I think those are good conversations for young soldiers to have.
Well, and especially given the line of work you're in, I think when I was 17, when I went off to college, Charles, I mean, I was immortal. It never crossed my mind. And there was older, wiser people who said, hey, plan, this is going to happen. Hopefully you'll live to be very old, but it's going to happen. And, that's when I think about the messages that I try to communicate to our listeners, there's that. It's a dangerous business that you're in, whether you're someone shooting at you or not. There's training accidents. There's just a lot of things that can happen. And I think that's something that when I think about the civilians understanding the sacrifices and the responsibility that you bear on our behalf, that's one of the things I'd like to share. And then also the family, regular listeners have heard this story a million times, so maybe I'll go through it, maybe I won't. But, I mean, service is a family tradition, and your daughter, Charles, is now picking up the sword.
Absolutely right. That's a good way to express it. So it's basically a family business for us. As you mentioned, both my grandfathers were drafted in World War II. My grandfather on my mother's side was an Irish immigrant, worked for the railroad for a time, was drafted and served overseas. Grandfather on my father's side was drafted. He was from Pennsylvania and actually was a cook in a German prisoner of war camp down in Alabama. That's how he met my grandmother. So that's kind of started it in the family. Several uncles on both sides served various times in the military. My father, my wife, and me, of course. And now if she makes it and she decides that that's something she wants to continue to do, my daughter, my oldest, who just turned 18, is looking to go to West Point herself.
So, Charles, give us a little bit of insight into that, because it's easy enough when my family and I get together for the holidays and we express what we're grateful for and we say prayers for other folks. I mean, what does that look like around the faint table with generations of military service?
Well, it's interesting because these topics do come up, of course, but that's not a main focus for us. If there's something that's relevant to something we're talking about, a funny vignette or something, we'll talk about it. And if we're doing preparatory training, if I'm teaching her how to do something, if I'm teaching her how to use a gun or use a map or a radio, which is, as an officer, that's going to be her primary weapon, it's a radio, not a rifle, then that'll come up. But otherwise, it's just fun. It's sharing stories. My mother, my father, and my sister were actually all here for Thanksgiving. And it's just good times, stories about when we were all young. And Emily, as I think she's mentioned on your show, was not a good child when she was little. She was very assertive, is what grandmother said. And now has turned into quite a nice young woman and probably professional soldier. So there is that aspect in there. But I think what inspired her to service, of course, is the example of her mother and her grandparents and her father, but also being around the types of people that we've been around through a career in the military and special operations community here at West Point. a lot of really great people, a lot of very satisfying work, and the chance to do some very interesting things. It's like you were saying, the Army has sent me to some very interesting places, too. Iraq, Afghanistan, Germany, Australia, Philippines. Got to go to a number of really interesting places because of it. I think that's inspiring to her, too.
Charles, when we come back, I want to do more edumacation. Folks, when we come back, we'll be talking Army 101. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined on the phone by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Faint. Lieutenant Colonel Faint is currently an instructor at West Point, an extensive military career, 27 years, a lot of it working, supporting special forces. Seven deployments, Charles?
That's right, seven.
Okay, and that was Afghanistan and Iraq, or are there places that we can't talk about? You can call it Pineland if you want.
Oh, I'd like to imply that I had a sexier career than that, but no, just Iraq and Afghanistan, Ben.
You know, when I think about trying to explain to people, civilians out there, to understand what it is that the burden that your families bear, Charles, were almost a lab experiment in integration, understanding. And I'm talking about specifically your time at Yale, and you touched on that on your article, Yale University and the Loneliness of the Military Professional. You start off, I mean, I guess you always dreamed of going to Yale, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm a Southern boy, and you know, Yale is something you read about in papers, and that's where you see the bad guy on The Simpsons, Mr. Burns, the Yale graduate. So that's about my only familiarity with it. But I wanted to go to University of Alabama or Texas A&M, but that's not the way it worked out.
So you're a Southerner going up into the heart of carpetbagger country. You're older than the average graduate student. You're a veteran, and you're from Alabama.
Yeah.
That should have made for some pretty interesting conversation initially.
It absolutely did. And, Ben, the only reason I applied to go to Yale was because Jeremy McChrystal was teaching there, and I worked for him at JSOC for a number of years. I had a lot of admiration for him. And I figured if it was good enough for him, then it was good enough for me to at least apply. And in the application process, to go to grad school is part of getting picked up to teach at West Point. I got rejected by some of the best countries, colleges in the world, and I got picked up by Texas A&M, and I love Texas A&M, and I could really see myself going to school there. I went there to look at houses and things like that, and then a couple weeks or so later, I got admitted to Yale. So I talked to my wife about it, I talked to my parents, and decided that was an opportunity I couldn't pass up. So I went up there with great apprehension, but as I explained in the article, it all worked out in the end.
Well, and I found it somewhat heartwarming because I would have expected a different initial reaction by your fellow students, you know, not only finding out that you're the old guy, but you're also a veteran. But you said it was more one of curiosity versus condemnation.
Absolutely.
Generally.
And it might be different now because this was 2011 when I went to school, and the environment at Yale is a lot different and not necessarily in a good way. I go back there frequently. I was just there last month to see some students and visit with General Crystal's class with some of my students. But I had a great experience there, Ben, and they were curious. They asked questions, some of which were awkward and some of which were inappropriate, but that's part of the learning process. I didn't resent it for it, and I liked the fact that they cared enough to ask questions because I had questions too. I'd spent my entire adult life in the Army. I was the son of a military career officer, so my first friends in several different demographics were at Yale, and to my surprise, many of them had never met a vet before. So contrary to my preconceived notions about everybody hating me and me having to fight hippies on the green every Friday or whatever ridiculousness I had in my mind, I had a good time. They were curious about me. I was curious about them, and I'm very grateful for the experience.
One of the things that you did with some of your comrades there, Charles, that I really respect and I love, and I'd love to see this replicated around the country. You said you started an Army 101 class.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us more about that.
So a couple different things we decided to do. I considered it a professional responsibility, as do a lot of officers, to host junior officers at my house for dinners and socials and things for a number of different reasons, professional development, getting to know people, morale, and stuff like that. Of course, I didn't have any junior officers or soldiers at Yale, so we invited students. to come over. And I thought that they might come over once just out of pure curiosity to see the old crazy veteran and his family. But they came over. They kept coming. We had great times. The only problem we had is they were having such a good time, they wouldn't leave. They're young people, so they had no concept of time. I was, you know, I'm 42. I have two small children, and at 9 o'clock, I'm ready to go to bed, and they're just getting started. So what we decided to do, myself and the handful of other vets and vet-adjacent people, like we had a CIA officer in our class who spent a lot of time around the military, we put on an Army 101 class to tell them what a sergeant was, to tell them what being that the Army's different than being in the Air Force, et cetera. And that was very useful. The Jackson Institute, which I was a part of, they paid for the pizza. We did the PowerPoint slides. Everybody came and had a good time. It was very useful to have that Army 101 class then.
And did you – the feedback was good?
Yes, absolutely. And for me, there's a little bit of self-interest. I would tell especially the undergrads that we worked with that people like me grow up to work for people like them. And they always thought that was kind of funny, but I meant it seriously, because if you look at just demographically by the numbers, who grows up to be the people who run our country, it's people who did their undergrad at Yale or Harvard or Columbia or Princeton, these elite schools. So for me, it was a good idea for them to type – start seeing us as people instead of abstract concepts when they've got to start making decisions to send us in harm's way down the road.
And I encourage people to visit Havoc Journal, HAVOK journal.com. Look for Yale University and the Loneliness of the Military Professional. Charles, there was a poem that you wrote, and I'm not going to ask you to read it on the air, but it's a very powerful piece. There's some anger maybe in there. For a civilian reading it, it's challenging, but people need to hear that stuff. Tell us a little bit about that before we hit the next break, because you wrote it a while ago, put it in the bottom drawer, and then brought it out again.
I did. So there's a historian / poet named Margaret Atwood, great writer, has written a lot of things that people would recognize, even if they don't know it was by her. She wrote many years ago a poem called The Loneliness of the Military Historian. And it's quoted in several different works. When I first got to West Point after grad school, someone forwarded me an article called Why Study War by Victor Hansen. It was written in 2007. And the quote from it was, "Confess, it's my profession that alarms you. This is why few people ask me to dinner, though Lord knows I don't go out of my way to be scary." And she was writing about her frustration being a female historian in a male-dominated field. But when I read that, I was like, oh, man, I know exactly how this feels, and I know that a lot of vets feel the same way. So what I did was I rewrote The Loneliness of the Military Historian to be The Loneliness of the Military Professional. And like you said, Ben, I started it in 2011, but I read it. I'm really not comfortable with sharing poetry. That's not my thing. I like to write prose. I like to write long-form articles. And also it sounded ungrateful to me. When I read it, I was like, this isn't coming across the way I felt about Yale and the whole experience. But I wrote it not for myself and not from my perspective, but for other veterans who are struggling. So it's not autobiographical completely. For example, I write about tattoos and PTSD in that piece. I have neither. But there's a lot in there that I did feel and I did express during that time period with the Occupy movement and being told check your privilege for the first time and these different upheavals going on at Yale and around the world. I thought it might be interesting at some point to get that down on paper, and that's ultimately what I did.
And don't get me started on the fifth-generation Yalie who folks sent them to school driving a Mercedes protesting the 1%, right?
Yeah. So there is that, but most of the people that I dealt with were just like young people everywhere. They just had a little more advantage at a very elite school. And okay. You know, I wrote it. I thought about it. It sat in the drawer for a number of years. And then I was watching, I think it was Netflix. I was watching this movie called Alias Grace. I think it was a movie. It might have been a series. And I was like, oh, this is very good. And then there was some verbiage on it that said, you know, this is based on something that Margaret Atwood wrote. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I started to write a poem based on something she wrote. But what finally pushed me across the finish line then was two things. This past fall, I was getting ready to teach my class called Leadership in Future War, I was going through the syllabus, making some updates, picked up a book called The Future of War by Lawrence Friedman, and the very first thing in the introduction was that same excerpt of Margaret Atwood's poem, the one I read earlier to your audience. And I was like, oh, that might be a sign that it's time for me to finish this up and put it on the street. And then Afghanistan fell, and I was like, yeah, it's time. And that's why it's posted now.
You know, folks, one thing you'll see when you read that poem, soldiers generally are the last ones who want war. In fact, they pray to avoid war. But it's the society, it's all of us who send them off to war, and we bear the burden of supporting them throughout that conflict and when they come home. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Buehler Garcia, will be right back with more from Charles Fain. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler Garcia. We're talking with Lieutenant Colonel Charles Fain. Colonel Fain is currently an instructor at West Point. He's got going into 28 years in service in the United States Army. He also is a writer for the Havoc Journal. Check out HavocJournal.com, H-A-V-O-K, Journal.com. A number of articles there that, Charles, they just struck me as appropriate to the theme today. And I want to talk about this not only because of the season, but also the context of where we are with our military and the civilian world right now. And there's a scene, one of my favorite movies is called Flight of the Intruder. And there's a scene where the two pilots are being court-martialed for going off on their own and doing a strike there in Vietnam. William Defoe plays Lieutenant Jake Grafton. And in the courts martial, he's quizzed about why he felt he did this. And his response, I want to read to you, he said, "My first bombardier and 50,000 Americans are dead. And can anyone tell me why? I realize that I'm Lieutenant Nobody. I'm not really sure about anything anymore. This war has become very confusing. Nobody wants to fight in it. Nobody seems to want to win it. Maybe it never should have happened, but people do die in it. Maybe for me it got personal because I know the difference between dying for something and dying for nothing." Charles, you had 7 tours of duty, but you don't consider yourself a combat veteran, which I...
That's correct. That's correct. I think it's an important difference. I'm a war veteran. I went to Iraq and Afghanistan 7 times, but I never served in combat. I got the combat action badge because somebody shot at me, not me shooting at them. It just wasn't my job. I'm an intel analyst, and I did all 7 tours in special operations units. If the intel guy is out shooting people, it's probably a bad day for everybody. And fortunately, it never got to that point for me. So, yeah, I saw a lot of war, but I didn't see any combat personally. I was okay with that. I would have been happy to do it, but that's not what the unit needed me to do. So I spent most of my time behind a computer.
Charles, folks have probably heard it first here on American Warrior Radio, but you've chosen to leave the Army. And did the Afghanistan situation play a role in that?
Yeah, it really did, Ben. So even though I didn't experience combat in Afghanistan or Iraq, I still cared about what happened. I still lost friends over there. We put an enormous amount of effort into those wars and an enormous amount of money. A lot of people got hurt on all sides, not just Americans. And it took me away from my family. I missed a lot of very important things growing up with my children because I was in Iraq or Afghanistan. And the types of jobs that I had, we worked hard in the task force, never had any days off, worked in very long hours, but it was very much worth it. We all loved it. I would have done more tours if I hadn't decided to take a new path. But it seemed to me, I think it was my third tour in Iraq. So I'd been to Iraq 3 times and Afghanistan 2 or 3 at this point. And it just kind of seemed that we were never going to be able to do what it took to win either of those conflicts. And I'm not responsible for making those types of decisions, and I understand there's a lot that goes into it. And there's probably some very good reasons why at the national level, through multiple administrations, we decided not to do those things. But it was still hard to get that. And that's the reason I left the task force and went to grad school, came to teach at West Point, was because I just couldn't see myself going back and forth on that in a war that we weren't going to be allowed to win. So I decided to take another track. And then the way that Afghanistan ended, I mean, I was getting close to the end anyway. I was getting close to my mandatory retirement date. And it was the way Afghanistan ended, it was just kind of it was hard. It was hard for a lot of vets. It was hard for me. And it just seemed like that was probably a good time to do it. So I talked to my boss and made sure that me retiring sooner than I expected wouldn't adversely affect the unit I'm currently serving with, because it's been very good to me, and I want to make sure that I didn't leave them on lurch. He assured me it wouldn't. So I dropped my paperwork, Ben, and on the 1st of August, I'll be a retiree. I'll be a civilian again for the first time in my entire adult life.
I read in one of your articles, Charles, you felt, as an officer, you felt like you lost that war.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, we lost, and I'm an officer in the Army, and I've got to bear some responsibility for it. I'm not going to lose any sleep over it, but I'm also not going to pretend that we won, because we didn't. And the way we left, it was very clear that we didn't win that war. I'm proud of what I did. I'm proud of what we did as a nation. I still think we've got the best nation, the best military in the world. But we don't get better by not looking problems square in the eye and seeing what happens. We could do a good AAR, after action review is what we called it. And special operations AARs are brutal, and they're honest. And I think we need that kind of honest brutality, so the next time something like this happens, we do a little bit better.
You know, Charles, it made me think, not to channel Sebastian Junger too much, but you know, in his writings, he talks about society's responsibility when we send the warriors off to war and when they come back, almost more importantly. And I got to tell you, I'm very concerned. After the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I was worried about the reaction and the ripples that would have amongst our veterans, particularly those who saw combat or served in some way in Afghanistan. And seems like there was a lot of feedback initially, but it's faded out awfully quickly, and that caused me even more concern, Charles. I mean, what are you seeing?
Absolutely. So I spent a lot of time on the phone after Afghanistan fell, because vets don't do a good job of expressing their feelings. They don't do a good job of asking for help, and they'll always say they don't need help, but they're always glad to have it. So I spent a lot of time talking to a lot of Afghan war vets about Afghanistan, making sure they were good, because it's another rock in the rucksack that people are carrying around emotionally, that if they don't do something to reduce that load, it's going to drag them down. And I know you know, and many of your listeners know, Ben, that the incidence of suicide in the military is considerably higher than it is in the civilian workforce for a number of reasons. And I want to make sure that Afghan war vets know that it was worth it, that it was important, what they did mattered. We took an L on it, but that doesn't mean that we quit. We got to keep going. Our country still needs us. Our family still needs us. Our community still needs us. And Afghanistan's over. It's time to find a second mission and do something else, find another way to serve if you're not in the military anymore. So I think what we saw in that initial reaction, that it was just an outpouring of emotion and disgust and disappointment and anger. And that's largely tapered off now, and folks are focused on other things. But I think we still need to keep in mind and keep helping those Afghan war vets, because this is something that's never going to go away from. They're always going to be Afghan war vets. This is always going to be a loss for us. It's always going to be on their mind.
There's a lot of comparisons to Vietnam, and some of those may be appropriate. Some of those may not be, Charles. But, again, I think about, you know, what we as civilians should be grateful for this season is to be grateful for families like yours and others, and frankly, our first responders, folks who volunteer to go out there and deal with that so that we don't have to. But on the gratitude side of it, I would like to see it extend more from just a free meal at Golden Corral on Veterans Day and a thank you for your service, to not, as a society, not sending young men and women off to fight anymore if we're not going to give them the liberty to win. Am I getting too political here?
No, not at all. And I think we can talk about this without getting political, because I know you like to keep it neutral on the show. And I do, too, since I'm still an Army officer and I don't want to drag it into politics. But I think that there's a lot to unpack there with that, Ben. And there's another article, an old article on Havoc, one of our first ones, called The Poor Game of Iraq. And it talks about how the war, it never was real for the average American. There's no war tax. There's no draft, et cetera, et cetera. So why wouldn't you have a war that lasted 20 years? When you got a situation that's got very few casualties, doesn't cost the average American anything, and you got an all-volunteer force, all these things kind of conspire to make an award just an abstract concept. You might read about it. If there's someone from your hometown that got killed, maybe you know about it, but that happens so rarely that it's just abstract. And that was one of the things when I was in grad school that I tried to make it real to my classmates. Hey, we're real people. These are real lives. We need to think really hard before we commit this. So if we're going to go in the future, let's go in. Let's go in hard. Let's go do what we need to do, and let's get out of there. Let's not try to stay for 20 years unless we're going to make it a commitment, a nationwide commitment. So far, I don't think we've seen a lot of that.
Charles, when we come back, I want to follow up on that with your soundtrack for the war. But before I do that, just to clarify, as an instructor in West Point, you probably have a challenge coin that you give to students who are doing outstanding work, right?
We do have one at MWI. We have a poker chip because we can't afford coins, but I've got dozens from my years of service, yes.
Well, okay, I want to be clear. This is not an endorsement by Charles Faint, West Point, the United States Army, or the Department of Defense, but you don't have to be an instructor at our nation's most prestigious military academy to carry a challenge coin. Both military and law enforcement personnel carry them, and you're now seeing private sector companies like American Warrior Radio pick up the tradition. Visit BossCoins.com to check out the design options. I sent them my logo and color size selections. Their in-house artist took it from there. I went from design to in my pocket in just a couple of weeks. And I'll sweeten the offer for you. Send me an email, bbg@AmericanWarriorRadio.com, and I'll put you directly in touch with a boss at Boss Custom Coins for a listener discount. I love my coins, and you will too. Visit BossCoins.com to get started. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bula Garcia. We're talking with Lieutenant Colonel Charles Faint. Lieutenant Colonel Faint currently is an instructor at West Point. He's got an extensive Army career that, unfortunately, you know, Charles, I'm happy for you and your family. I'm sad for America.
No need for that. The Army goes rolling along, just like the song says there, and I'm helping to train the next generation to take over for us. We're in good hands, Ben, even after I retire.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Well, I don't want to get ahead of myself. I do want to talk about that because I wonder about, you know, I talked about you passing the sword or the saber to your daughter, who's hopefully going to be in West Point soon and carrying on the family tradition. But you also spend some time with these young people and, you know, a couple of salty old dogs teaching the young pups new tricks. We'll talk a little bit about that, because in the article you wrote about that on the Havoc Journal, you quote Sun Tzu, who's one of my favorite ever writers. I don't understand most of the stuff but as much as you, but it's good stuff. And I get, well, in context of that, he says there's never been a protracted war from which a country has benefited. And I kept thinking about that in the context of Afghanistan, Charles.
Yeah, that goes all the way back to Thucydides and the war between the Spartans and the Athenians. So anytime a war lasts for a long period of time, it's just a grind. The best way to do it, of course, Sun Tzu says, not to fight at all. Sometimes you don't have that choice. Like, we didn't really have much of a choice after 9/11. There's going to be a fight. But to let it go on and on and on, it's a drain on the psyche of the nation. It's a drain on our young people. And it's a drain on our treasury. So I think that we should make sure that we have limited aims and we do what it takes to win in future conflicts. And that's not just me. That's not new. That's historical. It goes back thousands of years. Unfortunately, there are other concerns that take precedence, political concerns, and the military is a tool of politics. I'm not blaming politicians for anything here, but that's what it is. And that's one of the things that we try to help the future leaders of the Army and the nation understand through the Defensive Strategic Studies program, is that you don't want a protracted war. That the only time that that's useful is if you're an insurgent and you can't win unless you just drag it out until the other guy gets tired of fighting, which is what we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So Ben's dumb question of the show, Charles, and educate me here. How do you translate that down to a lieutenant or a captain in the field? Is it a situation where you don't always have to fight the enemy just because they're in front of you? Or is that when you do attack, be as violent and efficient as possible? Or how does that translate to that individual officer that, or soldier in the field?
Ben, that's a fantastic question. So it's always situationally dependent. But what I try to get my students to understand in the field or in the classroom is that they've always got to see the big picture. So there's a concept now that someone coined a number of years ago about the strategic corporal. And in most circumstances, that's an oxymoron because a corporal is kind of the lowest level of leader, so lowest non-commissioned officer. And that's hardly strategic. But the things that our corporals and our lieutenants do on the battlefield, especially now in this information area, have strategic consequences. If you desecrate a Koran deliberately or accidentally, if you run over a child on the street, if you kill someone you shouldn't, or if someone could just make everyone think that you did those things, they can have strategic level impact. So what I try to impart to my students is that they always need to consider what we call the second and third order effects, the long-term consequences of what you're going to do. So sometimes it might be very satisfying to go in there guns blazing, but sometimes that's not what you need to. In fact, sometimes that's what the enemy is trying to get you to do so they can exploit that to their advantage. So seeing the big picture is, I think, the most important thing and the hardest thing for young leaders to get through, Ben.
I tell you, Charles, if I was someone in Afghanistan now or most recently, I'd be awful grateful to your comrades who continue. And, I mean, this is going to make a great couple of movies someday, but we still have veterans who are going back in there or facilitating getting folks out, you know, initiatives like the Pineapple Express. Am I just crazy or is that – I mean, we're talking real – kind of Jack Ryan sort of stuff there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not directly affiliated with it. I have several friends who are doing it. In fact, I'd love to get them on your show to talk about this later on, Ben. Several individuals who are pulling their resources and their talent and their grit, putting it all together to help get folks out of Afghanistan. And we're talking Americans, we're talking third country nationals, we're talking Afghans, to get them out of that situation that they got left in after Afghanistan fell to the Taliban. What a great thing to spend your time doing.
Have your people contact my people. We'll get it done. Charles, we're kind of running out of time. You've heard several times what I'm grateful for. What are you and your family grateful for as a military family out there? Is it the opportunity to serve at such a high level, or you got a couple minutes? Let us know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, very briefly, because I see we only have one or two more minutes. I'm grateful for everything. I'm grateful for my family. I'm grateful for being born American in the 20th century and all of the luxuries and safety and things that we have, the security that we've got, that I'm grateful for the way our nation works together, even though there are forces trying to pull us apart. And today, Ben, I'm grateful for being on your show. I'm grateful for what you do for the veteran community, and I'd be really grateful if down the road someone picks you up and pushes you national, because I think this is the type of thing that America needs to hear.
Wow. I'm going to send you a challenge coin. Inside joke. But folks, you can read more. Visit. I'm grateful to the Havoc Journal. Real quick, before I forget, Charles, also, what's going on with the Second Mission Foundation? Any updates there?
Thanks for asking. So, We pushed out our second book, Armor of God, and I'm really looking forward to getting deep into publishing other people's books after I retire. As you know, it takes a long time to do anything. I'm running a business. I'm running a nonprofit. I'm teaching full-time. I'm being a parent. All these things take time, so I'm not doing some of them particularly well. But when I retire, I'll have more time to dedicate helping other people find their second mission after military service through the Second Mission Foundation. And I really look forward to helping them publish books, because I think vets have a lot to say that America needs to hear.
And again, talking about gratitude and coming back real quick, that you'll be experiencing it yourself, that transition. I don't know, technically you've told me what you're going to do, so I don't know if I'd really call it a civilian career. I guess it is technically. But, you know, for that veteran out there who is going to work at Boeing or who knows, you know, Procter & Gamble or someplace else, or starting their own business, you know, the veteran entrepreneurs out there,
right.
God bless them.
Right.
Still part of the Second Mission Foundation to support them and provide them the tools and the advice. I mean, none of us do this alone.
That's right. We're not in it alone, vet. We got entire nation willing to help us out. You just got to figure out what your second mission is going to be and let someone help you go figure it out.
Well, my second mission, I'm glad you mentioned it. Although when you said we're not national, I think our new listeners in Oberlin, Ohio might be a little shocked at that, Charles.
International.
International. Yeah, I do have that one fan in Ukraine that seems to download every single week. Charles, thank you so much for your time and for your family's time and for what you've done for our community and what you continue to do through the Second Mission Foundation. And folks, again, I encourage you to visit havocjournal.com, HAVOK journal.com. Not just Charles, but you'll see some amazing writing there that will help you as a civilian understand better and be able to reach out better for folks that maybe could use it right about now. Charles, take care.
Thanks, Ben.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can find this podcast and over 300 others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Find us on your favorite streaming platform. We're on Apple, Google, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn. We're everywhere. And as Charles mentioned, we need to spread these messages. So if you know of somebody who needs to hear these things, please reach out to them and encourage them to visit. Also, if you support what we're doing, please go to patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. You can help expand our capability to deliver these messages to more folks across the country. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
Been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.